And welcome back to the second half of Earth First Radio. I'm Uncle Dennis, and there's more important information coming up, so please keep that pencil and recycled paper handy. And we're going to go into our commentary for today. Our commentary is entitled Raiding the Rainforest for Global Treasure, a New Threat. And this is the first of a couple of different parts that I'm going to be reading. This is a rather lengthy story written by Mark Jaffe of The Enquirer. And let's get started. The world's beleaguered tropical rainforest, a band of woodland covering nearly 6% of the planet, but holding two-thirds of its species, is facing a new threat, Asian commercial logging. Fueled by a growing economy at home and falling trade barriers abroad, big Asian timber companies have fanned out across the globe. Here on South America's eastern coast, trucks piled high with logs come rumbling out of the rainforest almost daily on the first leg of a voyage halfway around the world to China. Barely on the scene a decade ago, Chinese and other Asian companies now control 90% of the $10 billion tropical timber trade, according to a European Commission study. This timber scramble threatens forests that are home to life as diverse as the red howler monkey and the korup tree, whose bark some scientists may say may provide a drug to fight AIDS. And in the last 50 years, more than half of this habitat, about 4 billion acres, has been obliterated by subsistence agriculture, mining, and development. Now the commercial loggers are compounding those problems. The most dramatic shift in the tropical timber trade has been away from Europe and America toward Asia, said Harold Wisdom, a professor of forestry at the Virginia Polytechnic Institute. Three Asian companies, according to forestry, environmental, and economic development officials, tend to cut more intensively and more rapidly than European companies that once dominated the trade. They also have tended to focus on smaller, more remote countries such as Suriname and Equatorial Guinea, where regulations are weak and corruption is rampant. Tropical loggers do not clear-cut the forest. They take only the most valuable trees. Still, logging degrades the forest, opens it up to hunters and farmers, and contributes to soil erosion and water pollution. This has, in a global sense, led to a downward trend in forest management, Wisdom said. International aid officials also voiced concern that one of the most valuable natural resources of these poor nations is being exported without any adequate compensation. The wood is being exported to Asian factories and little is left behind, said Giuseppe Topa, a World Bank forestry official. 80% of all tropical timber exports go to China, Japan, Malaysia, Indonesia, Taiwan, and South Korea, according to the International Tropical Timber Organization. China and Japan alone account for two-thirds of all tropical wood imports. And the Asian loggers girdle the globe. In Liberia, on Africa's west coast, the Oriental Timber Company, a subsidiary of an Indonesian conglomerate, is logging a 4-million-acre concession, an area larger than the state of Delaware. In Equatorial Guinea, the Malaysian timber giant Rumbundan Haiju has boasted annual exports from 100,000 cubic meters of wood to nearly 1 million cubic meters of wood in the last decade. In Cambodia's Kong province, logging is so widespread that three foreign timber companies control more than 500,000 acres, 14% of the country. In Belize, an offshore corporation backed by Malaysian interests is logging mahogany on 200,000 acres that includes the lands of traditional Maya Indian villages. And in Suriname, Indonesia, Malaysia, and Chinese companies have all set up operations in the last 5 years. The Surinamese government is hoping its forests will lure investment, increase exports, and help boost its faltering economy. It is, however, a gamble, one played out in Suriname's thick interior forests. The forests in Suriname are part of the Guyana Shield, 100 million acres of almost solid tropical woods stretching from Venezuela to Brazil's Amazon, with more than 1,000 species of trees, 800 species of plants, 674 species of birds and thousands of animals, including jaguars, howler monkeys, and giant armadillos. The Guyana Shield is one of the most diverse and complete rainforests left in the world. The trees reach heights of more than 120 feet, and the green canopy is sprinkled with flowers in yellow and purple. Flocks of parrots, daubed in bright greens and blues, soar over the treetops while neon blue morpho butterflies dance along the riverbanks. It is also home to the Maroons, the descendants of slaves who escaped from coastal plantations and fled to the interior more than 300 years ago. For nearly a century, the Maroons, whose name comes from the Spanish cimarron, wild or savage, waged a running war with Dutch and English colonists. The war ended in 1762 with the Sara Creek Peace Treaty, a blood oath in which each signatory, white colonist and Maroon, cut his arm and shed a few drops of blood into a calabash gourd. The blood was mixed with the earth and forest spring water, and each participant drank from the gourd. Under the treaty, the Maroons were given the Suriname interior as long as they stayed there. And so the Maroons have depended upon the forest for everything: food, water, building materials, medicine, and their spiritual nourishment. "You cannot live without the forest," explained Cesar Ajaco, the chief or captain of the Kayapati, one of the Maroon villages hardest hit by the logging. "The forest is our life. The forest is everything we have: our houses, our water, our food, our medicine. First comes from the forest, then comes God." So it was a shock when Linjin Wood Industries, a Chinese logging company, showed up last fall and bulldozed both trees and villagers' forest plots. "We were stunned," Ajaco said. "None of us knew what to do, what to say." His niece, Sylvia Ajaco, complained to the manager of the logging camps, who said that if she filed an official complaint, he would give her 15,000 Suriname guilders, about $6.50, in compensation. The manager of Jinlin Concession, who identified himself as Jackson Wang, said if the locals had complaints, they had to take them to the government. "We have all the required papers from the government," Wang said. "That wasn't good enough for the Maroons. The government is opening Maroon land to foreign loggers and miners without asking us, without consulting us, even though we've had a treaty for 200 years, said Cesar Ajaco, a small, wiry 60-year-old who has led the Kayapati for 17 years. This year, the Maroons filed a petition with the Inter-American Court of Human Rights in San Jose, Costa Rica, charging that the logging violates their 239-year-old treaty. The blood oath drew upon the power of powerful Samamaka Maroon ancestors and African gods and imbued the treaty with a sacred character, the petition states. Surinamese officials point out that only 8 million of the nation's 32 million acres of rainforest will be open to logging. Unfortunately for the Saramaka Maroons, the acres being offered to foreign loggers happen to be right where the Maroons live. "This is a problem," conceded Rene Somapawiro, deputy director of the government's Foundation for Forest Management and Production Control. "Every time we talk about forest development, the question of indigenous people comes up," Somapawiro said, "and so far we really don't have a good solution." Suriname became a Dutch colony in the late 17th century as part of a land swap with the English. The Dutch got Suriname and the English got New Amsterdam and Manhattan. Since gaining its independence from the Netherlands in 1975, Suriname has led a tumultuous political life. In 1993, after years of political ferment, which included a military coup and a civil war, the country has been desperate for foreign investment. Suriname had managed to alienate all the major international agencies and was in terrible economic shape, said Adrian Whitman, a forestry officer for the UN Food and Agricultural Organization. Then President Ronald Vientiane invited Asian logging companies to bid on concessions, and within a year, Chinese, Malaysian, and Indonesian companies had proposed 5 concessions covering nearly 12 million acres, or 40% of the entire country. The companies were promising to invest $26 million. Still, the size and number of bids raised concern both in Suriname and among international environmental organizations, so the brakes were put on logging plans. 2 large logging companies, Berjaya from Malaysia and MUSA, backed by Indonesian interests, did receive concessions totaling about 250,000 acres. 2 years ago, a major Chinese operation, Tacoba Forest Products, also began operations. Tacoba, according to Forest Monitor, a group based in Cambridge, England, that tracks international corporate timber operations, is in turn owned by Jinlin, a major Chinese timber company. Jinlin has operations and joint ventures with Malaysian and European timber companies and is exploring logging concessions in Cameroon and Guyana, according to the Forest Monitor. Last year, Finstyle, another Chinese company, began logging there. The Chinese companies are relative newcomers to an international scene that has been dominated by Malaysian, Indonesian, and European companies. The Chinese have been more active abroad since a ban on logging in China was imposed 2 years ago after devastating floods on the Yangtze River. And foreign governments have been welcoming. If a company wants to come in and invest, provide jobs, and is willing to obey the laws, we think they ought to be given a chance, said Soma Pawiro of Suriname's Foundation for Forest Management. At the heart of the dispute in Suriname interior are forces of growing global economy and the $10 billion a year international tropical timber trade. A drop in tariff barriers fostered by the World Trade Organization and easier movement of money around the globe has promoted investment, trade, and market demands. The large Asian timber companies have been able to quickly move hundreds of workers and millions of dollars worth of equipment around the world. In many cases, they have moved more quickly than government regulators who oversee their activities. This is especially true in poor tropical countries. These corporations prefer to operate in countries where laws regulating the exploitation of forest resources are weak, poorly enforced, or non-existent, said Victor Minotti, Director of Environmental Programs at the International Forum on Globalization, a San Francisco advocacy group. The push into the forest has been relentless, and the demand for wood is apparently insatiable. The World Bank estimates that by 2010, annual demand for wood is expected to grow by nearly 25% to 1.8 billion, with a B, cubic meters. After years of insisting that subsistence agriculture was the main cause of tropical forest loss, the World Bank reported that international logging has become a much greater factor in the problem. In some cases, the revenues of the companies eclipse the resources of the countries in which they operate. Shimmer International, a subsidiary of the Malaysian timber giant Rimbunan Haiju, has a major logging concession in Africa's Equatorial Guinea. Rimbunan's annual revenues are estimated at $1 billion by the South China Morning Post. Equatorial Guinea's 1999 gross domestic project was only $960 million. The result is these companies are laws unto themselves, said Philip Verbalen, head of Greenpeace International's Tropical Forest Campaign based in Brussels, Belgium. Barney Chan, general director of Sarawak Timber Association, which represents some of the big logging operators, including Rimbunan, said his members are improving the forestry and environmental parts of their operations. The big timber companies in Sarawak are adopting more realistic production programs and are now seriously looking at how to do sustainable forest management, Chan said. The Suriname government and the foreign timber companies here say they too want the forest to be a lasting resource. Jinlin's Wang said his company was obeying the rules, doing selective cutting under commercial specifications. He also noted that his company has invested in a new sawmill and was hiring local people. The environmental group Conservation International estimates that although perhaps only 10% of the trees are cut, 20 to 30% more of the forest is chewed up by roads and other logging activities. This was all too clear walking through the Jinlin concession. The company had plowed large, muddy roads about 45 feet wide into the forest, churning up huge piles of earth and creating fetid pools of green and brown water. Upended and broken trees were everywhere, and what were once plots of sweet potatoes, peanuts, ginger, cassava, palm, and banana crops planted in the forest by maroon villagers were now muddy pits. As for the government oversight, Suriname's Forest Foundation was created 2 years ago with Dutch aid to better promote and monitor logging activity. The foundation has upgraded the planning and permitting process, and this summer the newly elected president, Ronald Vientian, the same president who invited the Asians to Suriname in 1993, raised the taxes on gasoline in part to better finance forest management and regulation. Still, the Forest Foundation doesn't have enough inspectors to check the 245 logging concessions on 4.7 million acres. We won't be able to inspect every concession, but if we do the big ones, we'll still have some impact, Soma Pawiro said. But they will be playing catch-up. In the last 4 years, the area allocated to logging in Suriname has grown 41%, largely due to expansive concessions granted to foreign investors, according to an Inter-American Development Bank study. At the Kayapati village, the change has clearly been felt. It used to be that we cut timber we needed and then a little to sell, Cesar Ajaco said, but now there's pressure from the city, from the Chinese. You have to cut when and what the log traders want. If you don't, you don't get a contract, he said. The only thing limiting the cutting is manpower and machines. If it was possible to take all the wood in one fell swoop, they'd take it. And we'll continue on with this series next week, Raiding the Rainforest for Global Treasure, A New Threat, and written by Mark Jaff of The Inquirer. Moving to further news now on Earth First Radio, melting glaciers signal global warming. New data on melting glaciers provides strong evidence that the global climate is warming. For several years, evidence has been mounting that the global climate is getting warmer. But whether the unusual weather patterns, increasing temperatures, reduced snowfall, and rising sea levels are evidence of global warming or just passing blips on the Earth's bumpy weather record continues to stir controversy. Scientists studying climate change must be able to tease apart regional climate changes and short-term weather fluctuations, such as El Niño, from the permanent changes that are happening worldwide. Geologist Rick Wessels of Arizona State University is part of an international team of scientists studying the climate of the entire Earth with the Global Land Ice Measurement from Space project. The team, led by U.S. Geological Survey scientist Hugh Kiefer, is monitoring climate change by tracking the melting of glaciers across the Earth. In just 7 months of monitoring, Wessels has already seen melting in glaciers all over the Earth, which provides some solid evidence for global warming. Thousands of glaciers are melting, getting thinner, or even disappearing, he said. The flooding caused by runoff from these melting glaciers could have disastrous consequences. Because the melting and retreat is occurring at such a rapid pace, Wessels and his colleagues think global warming is most likely the explanation for the loss of glacial ice. The majority of these glaciers are receding, Wessels said. There is definitely a global climate change. And the Forest Service has proposed to log California's largest old-growth forest. Despite U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman's May 4th announcement that this administration is committing to providing roadless protection for our national forests, the Forest Service in California has recently proposed two new massive salvage logging operations within two roadless areas. The agency claims that commercial logging is necessary to protect local communities. The two proposed logging operations are located in Horse Linto Creek, the New River, and other key salmon watersheds of the Lower Trinity River Basin in the heart of the largest concentration of ancient forest habitat in Northern California. The forests and streams in the area provide critical refuge for a host of plants, fish, and wildlife, including rare orchids, northern spotted owls, goshawks, fishers, martens, wolverine, steelhead, chinook, and coho salmon. There is evidence that the proposed logging and road construction threatens to severely impact these plants and animals, as well as domestic water supplies in the local communities. The Six Rivers National Forest has released a draft plan describing its salvage logging proposal termed, and this is sort of ridiculous, Fuels Reduction for Community Protection Phase 1, which would log about 21 million board feet, enough to fill 4,200 logging trucks from 1,050 acres in the tributaries of the Trinity River, including approximately 334 acres within the Orleans Mountain Sea, Rare 2 roadless area in the East Fork of Horse Linto Creek. The Shasta Trinity National Forest Project, entitled the New River Community Protection and Burned Area Restoration Plan, would log within several hundred acres of uninventoried roadless areas contiguous to designated wilderness and large inventoried roadless areas. Recent Forest Service research demonstrates that the most effective method of protecting homes and structures is to reduce the amount of flammable material directly adjacent to them. In other words, if you want to protect a town, put the firebreak around the town. This proposed logging and road construction would remove trees more than 36 inches in diameter on remote ridges miles away from any community. And those large trees are exactly the ones that don't burn in forest fires. To truly protect communities, fuels reduction should focus on the highly flammable, small-diameter materials directly adjacent to homes. If you'd like more information, contact Ryan Henson of the California Wilderness Coalition. His number 530-474-4808. That's 530-474-4808. Tell him you want to know more about logging in Northern California, and tell him Uncle Dennis sent you. Moving to Southern California, the Los Padres National Forest roadless areas have been eyed for oil development. The Los Padres National Forest has nearly completed a plan detailing where oil exploration and development will be allowed in the forest. The plan is expected to reveal that five Los Padres roadless areas in Santa Barbara and Ventura counties contain 21 million barrels of oil. Los Padres National Forest oil plan will be released at a time when the fate of roadless conservation policy is still being decided in the courts. If the policy remains in effect, the only way to drill for oil under the five roadless areas is to use slant drilling technology. This may make drilling in the roadless areas too costly for the oil companies. Even if the courts eventually uphold the roadless policy, the Bush administration has announced its intention to allow local national forests to amend it. And this may result in more roadless area development than was originally intended under the policy. The areas that may be opened up to drilling in the Los Padres oil development plan are the Antimony, Spore, also known as Moon Canyon, Sawmill Badlands, Fox Mountain, and Cuyama roadless areas. The plan is a draft open for public comment, though the Forest Service will identify the roadless areas as places where drilling may be feasible. The agency cannot actually approve exploration until further analyses are completed. And once again, for more information, contact Ryan Henson of the California Wilderness Coalition. The number again, 530-474-4808. That's 530-474-4808. In the bad news, the Forest Service Chief announces roadless areas are open for logging. Forest Service Chief Bosworth has announced in a directive that commercial logging and road construction can resume on National Forest roadless areas with his permission. Bosworth also announced his intention to make roadless area protection subject to the forest planning process. Steve Holmer, campaign coordinator for the American Lands Alliance, said, "We are very disappointed with the Bush administration and Chief Bosworth's interim protection directive that opens up the remaining wild forest to commercial logging and road construction. Instead of defending the roadless area conservation rule in court and announcing a moratorium or executive order to halt new destructive projects, the president has made it clear that he wants to exploit these lands for more logging, mining, oil, and gas drilling, as we just heard a moment ago. Under existing forest plans, 50% of all roadless areas are slated for logging and road building. The forest planning regulations are also in limbo right now. The Bush administration has recently withdrawn new planning regulations issued by the Clinton administration, but has not yet offered new regulations that will be the basis for revising the roadless conservation rule. 20 years of forest planning failed to protect these roadless areas," said Holmer. "Returning to a failed process, which is often controlled by extractive interests, will only lead to the destruction of millions of acres of wild forest that should be protected by implementation of the roadless conservation rule." The administration is currently rewriting the planning regulations, so they are asking the public to trust a process that doesn't exist, said Holmer. Instead of handing these lands over to extractive industries, the Bush administration should listen to the 1.6 million Americans who spoke out for immediate and total protection of our remaining roadless areas and implement the rule as it was written. For more information, contact Steve Holmer of the American Lands Alliance at 202-547-9105. That's 202-547-9105 or wafcdc@americanlands.org. That's wafcdc@americanlands.org. .org. And that's about all the time we have for news here on Earth First Radio tonight. If you'd like to get news or comments from your bioregion to Earth First Radio, please send us email at cruiseef@cruiseio.com. That's cruiseef@cruiseio.com. cruiseef@cruiseio.com. Or you can send letters to Earth First Radio at P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Once again, that's Earth First Radio, P.O. Box 344, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And please send those announcements at least 3 weeks in advance. If you want more in-depth news and information about the Earth First movement, please subscribe to the Earth First Journal. Their address is P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. That's the Earth First Journal, P.O. Box 3023, Tucson, Arizona, 85702. If you want to listen to Earth First Radio live on your computer, you can do so every Thursday night at 8 p.m. Go to the website www.microradio.net and look for Free Radio Santa Cruz and listen in. That's www.microradio.net. And tune in. You can also check out live365.com. Search for Free Radio Santa Cruz and listen in. That's www.live365.com. And there's lots of great shows on Free Radio Santa Cruz anytime. And you can always find Earth First Radio archive shows on the World Wide Web at www.radioforall.net. That's www.radioforall.net. That's the number four in the middle there. Search for Earth First Radio. This show is number 145. Earth First Radio is carried on a growing number of free speech and non-commercial radio stations. Please ask your local station to rebroadcast Earth First Radio. Earth First Radio is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. Our theme music was written and performed by Daryl Cherney off the CD Keep It Wild. I'm Uncle Dennis. I want to thank you for listening to Earth First Radio. And now we're going to listen to some poetry by Gnome. Gnome is a poet out of Austin, Texas. And this one was recorded in Colorado at the Round River Rendezvous a couple of years back. It's called Dave Foreman in Disguise.
It's, me and Peg were talking or maybe joking or something that this rendezvous is pretty close to where Dave Foreman lives. So maybe he's here. Maybe it was just joking, though, but I know that he is here. He's just in disguise. So this is called Dave Foreman in Disguise. I was hiking through the San Juan Mounts around the rendezvous, thinking of all who've come and gone. What's there left to do? There's 20 years of history suddenly behind us, since five bold men in cowboy hats had long ago defined us. When I caught the scent of cigar smoke wafting through the breeze, and stumbled on a porta-potty stashed amongst the trees. Beside it stood a barbecue, topped with cheeseburgers and steaks. And a flask of gin and tonic, like I've heard Nancy makes. Well, I felt nature calling. Ahem. I opened the door and had to gag. There I found Dave Foreman taking a dump beneath the American flag. Foreman jumped in shock at this unsolicited relation. I said, "Excuse me, Mr. Foreman, but this deserves an explanation." Well, Dave said, "Rendezvous so close to home, and I was on the edge of tears. I miss you all sometimes. It's been too many years. Though I wake up scared at night, Earth First still feels appealing. I had to come to cleanse my soul. I had to come for healing." I asked Dave what he thought about this movement's reaction, but Foreman said, "Hush, hush, Gnome. This visit's called a covert action. Don't tell." I pondered what that meant. Then I couldn't believe my eyes. Foreman donned a skirt and tie-dye as part of his disguise. He put patchouli in his underarms and wore a t-shirt of the dead, then put a wig of dreadlocks above his balding head. Dave said, "They'll never know," and made me promise not to tell. "We'll be hanging out in next year's rendezvous as well." Well, the light was getting dimmer and the mosquitoes started stinging. Foreman headed off to the campfire to join along with Daryl singing. So when there's a hippie talking next to you, don't listen to his lies. Just whisper in his ear, "Hey, you're Dave Foreman in disguise."